I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
With Thanksgiving just around the corner, is there a beverage that we could identify as being uniquely American? Some things that come to mind immediately are the genre of the modern cocktail, wines from Lambrusco varieties, and cranberry juice. But what really stands out to me are the wide variety of corn-based whiskeys, including some moonshines, 100% corn whiskeys, and of course, the great American spirit, bourbon. But where does corn come from? Thousands of years ago, corn was much different than it is today. Imagine a bushy grass with thick, starchy stalks. And instead of ears of corn, picture the top of the grass to be more like a grain, like the top of some wheat. This grass is known as teosinte and is still abundant in Mesoamerica today. The kernels in ancient teosinte would have been so small and the fermentable starches in them so scant that no alcoholic product could have been made from these kernels, nor was it a foodstuff. So if people weren't eating or drinking the kernels, why did we choose this grass for domestication? Well, about 6,000 years ago, people probably weren't after the tiny kernels. They were most likely after the fermentable starches in the stalks. Much like chicha is made today, ancient humans would probably chew the stalks to sacrifice the starches, and this would ferment into a low-alcohol beverage. This became so popular that people began collecting the tiny kernels and replanting them. Over thousands of years, people had selected larger and larger kernels, and over time, large ears of corn became the more obvious and bountiful source of fermentable starch. Corn traveled north and became a staple among North American Native Americans. Corn traveled south and became enmeshed in the religious rituals of the Incan Empire, where beautiful women were socially separated, and their job was to chew corn mush, adding their enzymes to sacrifice the starches. These groups of women were to remain virgins, and the alcoholic beverage they made was of the utmost importance for maintaining the balance of their universe. Corn is one of the most popular global products. We use it as food for our livestock, in powders and medicines, in science. We use corn to make oils and flours, and we use it as a fermentable substance. But without the interest of our ancestors 6,000 years ago, we may never have come to corn ears as we know them. And our diets and lifestyles would be much different today. You've probably tried some 100% corn whiskeys, and most of us have indulged in bourbons with at least 51% corn in the mash bill. So this Thanksgiving, as you fill your table with foods indigenous to North America, when you reach for a spirit, make it a corn whiskey or a bourbon. Or if you have access to some, chicha would be the ultimate Thanksgiving beverage. It dates back thousands of years, and interest in corn's fermenting abilities is why it is domesticated today.
Patrick Capiello of Pearl and Ash has a few things to say about the 750 service.
Yes, I do. 750 has changed my life. I'm notoriously not the smartest wine buyer in the industry. So to have somebody pretty much lay it out for me step by step, it's definitely become a lot easier to buy wine, which isn't necessarily a good thing for my business partners, but it's worked really well for my clients. But yeah, no, 750 for sure. I remember times when wines would leave portfolios and, you know, they don't always send you a goodbye email when they do that. And tracking those wines down after it's been a year or more, it's not always been the easiest thing. And even with the internet as a whole, I think not always good resources. But 750 has done a great job, I think, of giving you the ability to find a wine no matter where it is.
Patrick Capiello of Pearl and Ash, he's a 750 user. You should be too. Alex Moreau on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
Great to have you here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So you are at Bernard Moreau in Sisson-Montrachet. You started working with your dad in 1995.
Yeah, exactly.
And what happened next?
So, yes. So after school, the 95, my first vintage at home was a vintage 95. I mean, vintage harvests and doing some work in a winery, of course. It wasn't a full vintage because, I finished my studies in July. So my first vintage was in 2 months later. So yes, 95. Between 95 and 99, I've been working a little bit overseas during the winter period. So it means in the South Hemisphere. I wanted to see something different before to be fully involved in my domain with my dad. And the only way for me to be able to do it was to go in the South Hemisphere to be away during winter. Whereas the work, there is less work, of course. You know, there is vineyard work, of course. But for me and for my dad, because he was alone, it was much more easier to go during this period. So I did vintage in New Zealand, winery called Matua Valley Wines in 97. And I did another vintage at Yarring Station. So it's a winery in Yarra Valley in Australia.
So you came back and you started working at the domain in 99?
In 99, yes. Came back. So yes, full vintage in 99 for me. So the real beginning was that. But I think to go overseas with a minimum of experience in my place was good, because I was able to understand much more what's going on, you know, in these big wineries. And firstly, as well, so to speak English, it was good. And so yes, 99. When I arrived, you know, you want to try different things, you want to see. And my dad gave me the chance to make some try. It was very important. I have to say that, because you know, sometimes there is some rivalry between generation, and I know that it's not only in Burgundy, it's everywhere, and it's not only in the wine business. But I was lucky to have my dad give me some trust me and left me some try. So you know, you start slowly. You want to move. So for example, if you want some concrete example, like I wanted to work with some different barrel supplier, so I change. So when you make a try, it's easier, because you can buy 1, 2, 3, 4 barrels, put in this cuvée. Okay, let's see. And I was able to do this, and I was very interested since the beginning to use only to work with only natural yeast, not natural fermentation. So it arrived since the beginning. I think I made some try in 98 already, and in 99 it goes for white and red, only work with natural yeast. So It's a kind of thing today, after 13 years, you've got experience with. But in the beginning, you know, when normally you've got fermentation happen during 3 weeks, and suddenly, because you make some try, all the cellar needs to be dry. You have to wait 3-4 months to get the wine dry. And you've got your dad behind you, say, "Are you sure?" Because it's a part of the fermentation, always very, very important. But I trust in natural yeast, you know. And since the beginning, I wanted to not try to avoid to have a touch on the of the wine making, you know, to be quite neutral. Try to leave the wine talk by itself. So these kind of things happened, and after I've made some try with a lighter fining or one cuvée without any filtration, you know, I speak for whites now, you know, whites without filtration, early 2000s, it was not in all the mind, and I wanted to make that, to try. And 2001, for example, on cuvée of our Chasse Amourache Premier Cru La Malle 3, I made a try on the longer aging on lees, up to 18 months before my dad used to bottle all his wine before the next harvest. So white, red, generic wines, while I'm still doing that for the generic wine, Bourgogne Ligoté, Bourgogne Chardonnay, Bourgogne Pinot Noir. But for the other wines, the Chassagne Village Blanc, Chassagne Village Rouge, and all the Premier Cru, now we do a longer aging. So in 2001, I made my first try on Chassin Premier Cru La Malle 3. It was 15 months aging. So, and I really enjoy it. And 2003, it was a vintage a bit different because of the climate. So I did not generalize this my idea, but in the first turn in the winemaking, I think in the style of the domain is compared to what we make now is 2004. 2004 is definitely the vintage where we decided to do longer aging only. So like today, as we do for my big cuvée of Chassagne Village Blanc, you know, we run a total of 14 hectares today on Chassagne Morachet all together, and our cuvée of Chassagne Village Blanc is it's many vineyards, but it's more than 4 hectares. It's between 4 and 5 soon. So it's a very, very big cuvée. We are talking about more than 2,000 cases or single bottling, single blend. So it's very important for us, this cuvée. And yes, now we are about, depends the vintage, between 14 months, 15 months age for this cuvée. And for the premier cru, that's for sure, it's 18 months. So two winters. I like this. I wanted to move to that, to take my time to bottle the wine. And, you know, because when you... What I didn't like in a shorter aging, not the wine, it's just because your bottling date is depending very much about your future picking date. If you've got a early harvest, you're going to have a shorter aging. So if you've got the room and the vats or barrels or space in your cellar, I wanted to go further in the aging and be able to bottle my wine when we think it's ready. When I say 14 months or 18 months, it's general. I mean, we are working very much on the pilot, and we think the wine is ready to go. Okay, we find the wine. And it's another thing is now most of my wine, especially for the vintage 2011, for example, they were bottled without any filtration. So for white, you know, it's a step to bottle the wine without any filtration, because I'm not against filtration. It just, we try to make everything before to be able to do it. But if, for example, something happen, if the wine stay very cloudy, I don't want to keep in my mind no filtration, because I think very, very cloudy wines, you lose purity. Why I decided to try to make some wine without any filtration is just because when you've got two winters, the wine settle. And when you taste the wine, you say, okay, it's clear. If you are not sure, you can make an analysis. The analysis say it is very low in terms of turbidity. And I say, why should I make one more transfer to this wine if I'm able to do it like that? So it's just like that. The answer is just this meaning, you know. And today, yeah, we work like that.
What are the differences in the taste between the wines pre-99, pre-2004, and today?
I think before, our wine were a little bit more approachable, younger, a bit more charming, a little bit more more that you can touch more a larger public, you know, because the wine were like for everybody. I wanted to go further to make the wine a bit more precise, fresher, and lean. So it means you don't go in a way to make super approachable wine. You work more on the austerity. But I don't want to make too tight wine. I just want to make it fresher. So, you know, it means I changed, as I said, my barrel supplier to get some barrel more fresher. I don't want some sweetness in my wood. I don't stir the wine, or nearly none. No racking. And I like to finalize my aging in tank, in stainless steel tank, because I like to leave the wine few weeks, all together, blended, and I think the wine become much more all together. You know, because when you do an aging in different barrels, especially in a larger cuvée, and you blend and you bottle your wine just 3 weeks or months after, I think the wine need more time to be all together. Good mariage for all those barrels. And I think with the end of the aging in tank, we get much more precise fruit, more energy into the wine, more fresher. But you lose of the early drinkability. In general, I speak in general, because after you've got some vintages like what you have got now on the market, vintage like 2011, where it's naturally more charming because of the growing season, because of the, especially it was much more about the condition of the climate during harvest, where we had a very, very warm weather and we had a rising sugar very fast at the end and the flavor come very, very quickly. And so we've got this 2011 vintage balance between, it seems to be powerful on the nose and in attack in the mouth, but you finish on a good freshness because the acid is there. And on a vintage like that, the wine, doesn't matter if you do a longer aging, the wine is a bit more charming because it's like that. In the opposite vintage, like 2007, 2010, when it's built with a big bone of acidity, when you finish your aging in stainless, it makes the wine even tighter. So you need to find the right people to be able to understand this kind of wine and to be able to sell it and drink it. And for the moment, we stay on that. It's now nearly 10 years. We changed the style. I'm able to sell it and I want to stay in this style. Because I work with my brother and we go in the same direction. This is important to say. When we want to change something, we move in the same direction. And we don't make million and million of bottles. So, you know, I think today we've got maybe the privilege to be able to make the wine we want to make, and not necessarily to make the wines that the market want to have. You know what I mean?
Because of the way that Burgundy has a strong market, you feel that you can make wines that you want to make and they'll sell.
I hope so. I hope it's not too proud to say that, but I think as far as the wine is well made and you find a customer to enjoy it, this is the best way. And it's why I think a Burgundy can be sometimes so complicated to understand, because you've got so many terroirs, and in this terroir, you've got so many winemaker domain where they've got their own style, and sometimes people can be a little bit lost because, for example, you can make, you know, the idea where Puligny Montrachet should be tighter, leaner, compared to a Chassagne Montrachet, where it's more, bit more fruity, more masculine. Today, depending where you are, depending who you are, on the blind tasting, you can reverse, you know? Like, you know, sometimes Meursault, the appellation of Meursault has got the image. Sometimes people say, oh, it's rich Chardonnay, but today, when you taste some Meursault, there is plenty of different style. There is some big Meursault, but there is some very elegant and precise Meursault as well. So, winemaking, where it's from, of course, but winemaking as well. And I think there is room for everybody. And so today, it's good to try to keep a style, because you are identified as a style, and people, Bernard Moreau, he makes style like that, and if I want this style, I can go for his wine. If I want a more fruity wine, I go for another producer. And I think there is room for everybody.
In the way that you've done changes in the winery itself, in the cuve, has your brother Benoit done changes in the way that the vineyards are managed? Because he's focused more on the vines.
On the vines, yes, you're right, yeah. We go slowly and slowly on the BO approach. I mean, the hardest work was done in 2004, 2005, where we don't use any more herbicides since that. And I think one of the most important things for me to realize the earth, it's this. I think, of course, there is a chemical use after in the vineyard, but herbicides, it can be one of the most important points. So we start from that. You know, the kind of thing when you don't want to, if you want to do it, sometimes you want to do it everything in once, and it's a lot of work, you can make some mistakes. So we did slowly. And now today we are moving slowly to use less chemical or different chemical, in fact. Yeah, and Benoit, my brother, look after all this. It's not a huge business, and we make each year around, depending on the vintage, normal vintage, not like 2012 or 2013, but normal vintage, around 8,000 cases. Yes, I'm more involved in the winemaking, and my brother in the vineyard managing, but we discuss together, we know where we go. Yeah.
What are the different vineyard parcels that you produce bottlings from?
So we start from the beginning. Our entry level, it's Bourgogne-Aligoté, made from Chassagne-Montrachet vineyard. I mean, area, not vineyard, of course. Bourgogne-Aligoté. We made some Bourgogne-Chardonnay as well. And after, we make a little bit of Saint-Aubin. Saint-Aubin premier cru en Remilly. Then, as I said in the beginning, a big, big, big cuvée of Chassagne Village. It's come from a blend from different vineyards located both sides of the appellation. It's about one third from the south part of Chassagne-Montrachet, just below the premier cru Morgeau and Changuin, where we get the body of the blend and the minerality. Then two-thirds from the north part of Chassagne-Montrachet, close to the border with Pulligny-Montrachet, in fact, where we get more of this freshness, this fruitiness here. And everything is hand-picked and blended all together right after the pressing. And as I said, fermented under natural yeast and put in barrel and aged during the blends. Between 14 and 15 months. And after, we've got six different premiers crus. Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru Les Chenevottes, Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru La Malle 3, Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru Les Changuins, Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru Morgeau, Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru Les Vergers, et Chassagne-Montrachet premier cru Les Grandes Ruchottes. And then, purchasing grapes. Since the vintage 2008, we produce some Bâtard Montrachet. And since the vintage 2010, we produce some Chevalier Montrachet. We are talking barrels, okay? One barrel of Bâtard, two barrels of Chevalier. Yeah.
So the different premier crus, how would I approach them as different parcels that translate to different wines if I were a consumer? What should I know about each of those parcels?
Okay. Premier cru like Les Chenevottes. Chenevottes is a vineyard located more in a slope. It's not a rear. It's located in a little valley, if you can say that. It's not very steep. there is some light soil, and the wine here can be very, very ripe. And for my opinion, especially because we've got two vineyards there, one is nearly 50 years old, one is over 60 years old. Most of the time, I go and pick this vineyard the first day of my harvest, because we try to keep some freshness in our Chardonnay, to keep the elegance and the zesty kind of Chardonnay you can get sometime. Chenvotte, I try to pick it earlier, because in this vineyard, if you wait, you got the rising sugar comes very, very fast, and you can producing a Chardonnay with natural 14% of alcohol. And of course, it will be bigger, it will be richer, it will be very approachable, very direct wine. But for me, too much. And I know it is vineyard because we've got a lot of bunches per vine, but very, very little, what we call millerandage. It's a very, very little, it's like when you've got a bat flowering, you know, you've got in the same bunch, you've got big berries and very small berries. And because you've got a lot of small berries in this vineyard, you can understand that if you wait too long, the sugar goes very fast and the acid drop. So the flavor comes very, very fast here.
In small berries, the sugar jumps faster?
The sugar climb.
I see.
Yeah.
And that's because there's less volume of juice.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So if you get uneven fruit set, you can have higher sugars as a problem when you harvest.
After you have to, yes, I like to have some millerandage, but if your vineyard has got only this because it's old, you have to keep an eye about acidity, because the flavor is there. You don't have to wait 13.5 to get the right flavor. You can have the flavor a little bit before, and you keep the natural freshness. So we are more working on that for the Chenvotte.
Has alcohol been a concern for you across the board? Have you decided that you wanted lower alcohol levels?
For the moment, in Burgundy, except vintage like 2009 or 2003, where it can be an issue, sometimes in 2006 as well, we don't have too much trouble. But we can see in the previous recent vintage, like if you wait too long, yes, it can be a problem. And so picking date is always very important. And I've seen from my point of view, some evolution, you know, nearly 20 years ago when I started, we can see some competition sometime, not a competition, but between who's going to pick the latest. And for me now, today, make any sense, because it depends how old is your vineyard, what is the crop. I mean, if you've got 25 hectoliters on this vineyard because it's 60 years old, you will be right before somebody else who's got 50 hectoliters. And in my domain, my oldest vineyard, like Le Grand Ruchot, this year again, we did 24 hectoliters per hectare. And of course, I picked this one the first day. There's no point to wait 5 more days, because you lose the freshness. And after, when you've got 45, 50, 55 hectoliters on some vineyards, you have to wait longer because you need more sun. That's normal. So, you know, and after, if you spray against botrytis or not, you will be riper before or not, you know, all this decision. So for me today, there is no philosophy to say, okay, I'm going to be the latest to pick. No, it just depends how you manage your vineyard, what is the quantity, and try to do your best with the picking date. Believe me, it's very, very difficult because everything is hand-picked. But I mean, what I said now, it's for all the Burgundians. You know, when everything is hand-picked, we try to wait at the last moment to choose the right date. But the employee, because suddenly, you know, we've got every day during the year, four people work for us, with us. And suddenly we are 40 in the vineyard. So when we have to say to pickers, okay, come, it's ready to go. It's not like that. They don't wait for us, you know. Some of them, they work, so they have to take holidays. So we try to play between what we want and what people can do. You know, so this year we just say a week before, okay, can you come next week? So yeah, you know, it worked like that, and after, of course, there is the weather. The weather is an issue as well.
So the Chenevaux fruit, after you pick, it goes to the winery, and how is that handled?
So press. It depends. It can be a full. All bunch press, or like what I did last year with the vintage 2012, because we had a little bit of hail, and there was some. The problem with hail is on one bunch you can have some one or two or three impact of hail, where this berry never gets ripe. But never, if you taste it, you can't eat it. So if you cannot eat it, you're not going to make good wine with it. So in 2012, we decided to do a very, very soft press, longer press, with no crushing. So all bunch. Normally, I like to crush a little bit my Chardonnay, just a little bit, to get more free run juice, and with a long press. But yeah, so for the juice, it's like that. And after, simple. After the pressing, everything goes in tank, settle with gravity for night, then by gravity down to the barrel, and wait for the natural yeast fermentation. And it happens. It depends the vintage, but this year it was fast. It starts after 2 or 3 days, but it can be 4, 5, 6 days. Yeah.
And what about the other 5 Premier Crus that you work?
So, Premier Cru Les Vergers, Chassin Premier Cru Les Vergers, so it touches the Chenevaux, but there is more slope, and the soil is very different, very, very limestone, very rocky soil. So here, most of the time, Les Vergers is a terroir where we get the highest acidity, the lowest pH. And this is keeps. I mean, it's true in cold vintage and it's true in warm vintage, like 2009. It's always like that. So of course, in a cooler year, Verger can be a bit austere, because you know, it's not super charming. But in a warmer vintage, Verger can be one of the most balanced Premier Cru we can have. And for me, I like very much Verger, for my personal taste. After, we've got Premier Cru Lamal 3, which is very central of Chassin-Montrachet. In fact, the village of Chassin-Montrachet, there is one road, and make like a cycle. And inside this cycle, there is Premier Cru Lamal 3. And Mal 3, the soil is a little bit deeper. It depends where you are. We've got three blocks, but the soil is a little bit deeper. But for our Mal 3, in terms of minerality and freshness, it's not very far from Les Vergers. Mal 3 is a terroir. The wine seems to be on the nose, and the attack seems to be big. Not big, but it's going to be richer. But after, you've got this length. This minerality comes and makes the wine quite fresh. So there is not a huge, for me, when I do a tasting, most of the time I start Verger then direct Maltois. In my range of premier cru, I start from the tighter style, go to the bigger style. After we've got the Chassin premier cru Les Chanquins, which is geographically between La premier cru Maltois and premier cru Morgeau, and in Chanquin we can feel there is deeper soil. So Chanquin, you can, for people who know the terroir of Chassin-Morachet, when you test a Chanquin, you can feel you are on the way to go to Morgeau, because Morgeau, this is another premier cru we've got. Morgeau is known to make some premier cru with more body, more structure. It's a good terroir to make red wine as well. And Morgeau can be a premier cru very big, again. Not like Schoenvoet, hein? Just a big premier cru. And again, with Morgeau, for me, it's a kind of terroir I avoid to pick too late. So back to the Chanquin. Chanquin is geographically between Maltois and Morgeau. And I will say in the tasting, it's about the same thing. Sometimes Chanquin can be a little bit leaner, more like La Maltois, and some vintages, it will be more on the style of Morgeau, where it's a bit bigger. So Chanquin, it's always a terroir. It depends on the vintage. Definitely. Before harvest, you cannot say, you know. It's when it's in the barrel, say, okay, it will be more like that or like that this year. And Morgeau, as I said, it's more richer, more bigger, and it's aged very well. And after we've got we classify a little bit as a next step premier cru for us, our premier cru Les Grandes Ruchottes, which is our oldest vineyard, planted by my grandfather in 1939, and where it's quite steep there is not much topsoil. It's about in centimeters, it's about 25-30 centimeters. And under that, there is the limestone, but like everywhere in Chassin-Morachet, but there is the limestone as a rock, what we call it in French, the La Roche-Mère, the mother rock. So in this vineyard, you can taste the minerality very much. Yes. And Les Grandes Ruchottes has got, you know, it's like some special terroir where it seems to be powerful, but it's always balanced with a huge minerality. And this makes a big difference for me with this terroir.
In terms of ageability, do you find that the Grand Ruchotte ages the longest of the premier crus?
Yes, definitely. And it's definitely Grand Ruchotte for me. You know, it's like it's the same altitude, same line as the Chassin-Morachet Les Cayrets, Chassin-Morachet La Romanée. Oh, for me, it's like you know, like Immersault Perrière. It is a kind of terroir. It's not for early drinking. You know, it's not a premier cru you put in a blind tasting to win a trophy. You know, because you need more time. For me, I like them between 4 to 8 years. For me, when my clients ask me when should I drink my wine, I say it depends on your taste. For me, it's more about, in general, it's more about the style people love to drink it. I divide it by three parts. Young, it means for 11, now to 3 years. If people, they love the Chardonnay with the very approachable young fruit, somewhere the winemaking style, I say to my customer, doing them in the next 2 to 3 years. And sometimes I say, yes, but it's not a shame to drink it too young. I say, if you prefer this style, just enjoy it like now. It's not a problem. After, the second step for me is between 3 and 7 and 8 years old. It's where I drink most of my wine, because the winemaking go backwards and the terroir is more obvious. But you still have some freshness because it's not that old. And I like them. Like, for example, now the 2004, 2007 start to be very good, you know, with this. And after, you've got the third step. When you pass the 8, the 10 years old, the 15 years old, where the aromas can be very different, and but you've got a lot of complexity. And I liked it. I like it very much. But I understand that sometimes I can see people, sometimes they ask, they want to drink old wine, but in fact, they don't like it. They prefer the younger style. So it's more about, it's not about aging potential. It's, for me, it's more about a moment where you want to drink, at which level. Yeah.
And what about the Grand Cruz that you've been working with? You started with Batard Montmorency in 2008, mm-hmm. Chevalier in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about, and what's the difference for you working with Grand Cru fruit as opposed to the Premier Cruz that historically the domain has been associated with?
I wanted to make it, and for me, you know, the only way to be able to make a Grand Cru one day was through the purchasing grape. Because to buy a land is too expensive for me. And so Batard Montmorency, for my young experience with this terroir, but I've tested a lot from my colleagues, Batard Montmorency is the most powerful Grand Cru, in my opinion. It's like Morgeau. You talk about Morgeau. Morgeau, for me, if I can make a comparison between my premier cru and with the Grand Cru style I've got now, I will say Batard will go more in a Morgeau style with the most powerful. But when it's well made, Batard, you can avoid this heaviness because sometimes Batard can be big as well. And I will compare the Chevalier more in the Grand Cru short style, more on the mineral and the fresh style of the Grand Cru. So, and I can, it's funny because since we've made this Grand Cru, I can feel the taste of the people, my customer. I mean, some people say, I'm in the beginning or when we taste the premier cru, I can feel, okay, this one is going to prefer the Batard instead to the Chevalier, or this one is prefer the Chevalier instead of Batard. You can, it's just a personal taste. It's not to say the Chevalier, in the idea, Chevalier is always better, supposed to be better than Batard. But I think for me, it's more about the style. Yeah. Chevalier is more about the finesse, the elegance, the class, and le Batard is more on the structure. Yeah.
And you also make some red wines. You make Volnay.
Exactly. So I make some red on Chassagne as well. Some Bourgogne Rouge. I went to a level of Bourgogne, located on Chassagne Montmorency, and some Chassagne Montmorency Village. We call it Vieille Vigne. It's a blend of our oldest vineyards, which is mean between 50, 55 years old. Then we've got one single premier cru Chassagne Montmorency. This is called Chassagne Montmorency premier cru La Cardeuse, which is for us a monopole. So it means we are the only producer to own this block. And La Cardeuse is a subclimate of Morgeau. It's located in the big area of Morgeau. Morgeau altogether, it's around 60 hectares. And the La Cardeuse, we own 0.8 hectares. So it's about 2 acres, I believe. So we do this one as a monopole. And then you're right, we make now some Volnay. As the same way as we do the Grand Cru. We purchase the grapes, we pick ourselves the grape as well. So we do some Volnay Centeno, some Volnay, a little bit of Volnay Claudichen, and Volnay Cailloret. We wanted to make some Vernet. Why? Because in Chassin-Morachet, I made only three wines, Bourgogne, Chassagne, and Chassin-Morachet Premier Cru. And we wanted to extend a little bit our range of red. And in the family, my parents and my brother, we really love Volnay. So I wanted to try to get some grapes, and we were able to find some good location, good vineyards, and you know, like Claude Echen and Cayré, which is probably the best with some others, but some of the best terroir in Volnay. And but we are talking about very limited cuvées. Hein? Volnay Claude Echen is 2 barrels, Volnay Centenot and Cayré, normally it's 5 barrels. Unfortunately, the last 2 years it was more 2 barrels of each because of the climate. But yes, I'm happy to diversify a little bit our range of reds. But it will stay under control. I mean, I don't want to make wine everywhere on the Côte. You know, I'm in Côte de Beaune. I wanted to make something a little bit further, like Volnay. And I want to stay and keep, stay identified as a Côte de Beaune producer. I mean, I won't produce, I hope. I mean, maybe I will, but I don't see in a short future to be able to make some Côte de Nuit. No, I want to stay around where I am. Yeah.
And for you, what is the difference between a red wine from Chassin-Morachet and a red wine from Volnay?
Volnay, it is, for me, maybe the most elegant appellation in Côte de Beaune. It's got this delicate tannin, this feminine touch, compared to Pommard, for example, where it's more on a masculine style. But in Volnay, you can find some firm wine as well. Like Cayré, it's, I think for me, between the difference between Volnay Centenot and Volnay Cayré, it will be the same step as I have between my Premier Cru and Ruchotte, for example. It's one more step in the hierarchy of Premier Cru. More mineral, more class. It's just one or two things make the wine just must. Yeah. Yeah. And after, so you've got this difference between Volnay Centenot, Claude Echen and Cayré. And Chassin-Morachet. So Chassin-Morachet is known for white wine, but there is a lot of red wine. And historically, it was in the 30s, I believe it was between 60 and 70% of the total production of Chassin-Morachet was Pinot Noir. But we are clear, but we stay identified as a white wine area because of the Grand Cru. The Grand Cru is only in Chardonnay, and the top Premier Cru is Chardonnay. But Chassin Rouge is not rare. And the image of Chassin Rouge is a bit tough. In export market to try to sell some Chassin Rouge, it need more time. You have to show the wine, you have to discuss with people. But I believe there is some good evolution with the quality of reds on this appellation, because people have to sell it and they want to send their own name, and they, you know, the reputation, which is true of Chassin-Morachet, especially on the village level, it's more about tannic, rustic, a bit firm, Côte de Beaune, which is true. And I think now we can see more and more soft Chassin Rouge. People just want to relax a little bit on the extraction. On the Premier Cru level, you've got room for extraction. You can go further. It won't be that tannic, just because of the vineyard. So as for sure, Chassin-Morachet red in general is much more on the masculine style. And so it's why, as well, we wanted to make some Volnay, to make something softer and very different. Yeah.
How do you find it to be different to handle Chardonnay from Pinot Noir in the vineyard, or excuse me, in the winery? Do you approach the two grapes very differently?
Yeah. I'm in the white area, but I love to make reds. And I love to drink reds. I love to make reds. And we keep attention for that with my brother. And you know, our largest cuvée of red is Chassaing Village. So as I said, technically it was the most difficult vineyard to treat to avoid this rustic and this tannic style. So yes, the approach is a little bit different. Since the beginning, I mean, everything is hand-picked, but we deliver the grape to the winery in a little bin of 13, 15 kilo. So it's soft. We don't want to have too much.
You don't want to break the skins in transit to the
exactly.
winery.
We don't. Yes, we want entire skin, entire berry. So yes, of course, and everything goes on a sorting table. So we are depends how healthy is the crop, but between 6 and 8 around the sorting table. Then everything is this stem for the village and the Bourgogne, and we try to get the most entire berry to preserve the skin and to leave the maceration slowly goes in these entire berries. And I believe very much in that. And since this is a big change for us as well, since 2009, I start slowly to keep some wall cluster in proportion in my reds, but for the Promicru level for the moment. So for my Chassaing Promicru Red Lacardeuse, now I'm between 30-40%, and for my frivolness as well.
So using more stems?
More stems, yes. I like the idea to get this pre-fermentation into the berry. I think I have to learn. You know, you need experience for this kind of winemaking. I see some friends. I go to see some friends in Burgundy. I think the stem is not instinct because it's green. It's just the what happened in the berries what is interesting. So and
because you're not pressing the fruit.
Exactly. We go very we are pressing as after a few days, but in the beginning we don't touch it. Yeah. And for people who follow us, especially on our Monopole Lacardeuse for us, people told me, oh, this is different. What have you done? So people think, people taste it, and people ask me. So it's not when you make a change, it's because you want to make something different, and it happens, you know. And I think today, this is much more delicate. You know, there is some opinion about old bunch were supposed to make rustic wine because we keep the stem. I think it's not true. The top domain in Burgundy who keep a large part of stems and don't make any rustic wine, or they make very elegant wines. But that's for sure. This wine making, I don't want to say affect, but has got a direct impact of the style is going to be your wine. So for the moment, I stay a big third of proportion. And maybe I will go further, but we go slowly. And after, it depends on the vintage, of course. Yes, because if you go on that, you need to have a very healthy crop. So and if it's not, the sorting table is absolutely obligatory. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about weather, because Volnay and the Côte de Beaune in general have seen a lot of hail in the last couple of vintages and really reduced yields in the Côte de Beaune. I've visited growers and they have barrels, you know, lined up against the wall quite often because they don't have the juice to fill those barrels with in the last couple of vintages.
Yeah.
What's going on in the Côte de Beaune? How are those vintages affected you?
So 2012, this hailstorm touched all the Côte de Beaune. It's very rare, you know. Normally it can be one appellation, or it's north of one appellation and south from the other appellation. But in 2012, it was all the Côte de Beaune. More and less worse for few appellations, but in Chassagne, I had some vineyard estimated by my insurance 40, 45, 50%. So it's not nothing, you know. In 2013, it was much more on the north. In Chassagne, we had just the cue of the storm. So honestly, we had nothing. And we cannot say more than that, because when we see some vineyards in Savigny-les-Beaune or in Pommard this year, we don't say we had any hail this year, because there's nothing to compare. But it's going to be an issue, yes, for sure. So after, it depends. When it's 1 year, it's already difficult. When it's 2 years, we are talking about a financial problem. I think for people who sell wine under their own bottle, their own label, like us, we will feel it next year, because this vintage 2012 is still in barrel. And we will feel the financial problem when it will be on the market, because when you need some money and you are already shipped all your wine, this is going to be an issue. So 2013 Chassagne, I'm okay. There is few vineyards where we had not much wine, but it's okay, because some other, it's so I'm not complain. But that's for sure some. I've got some friends in Volnay. It's going to be a problem. And it doesn't matter if it's people or known or not known. I mean, if you are known, who's got some stock today? Not much people, you know. And when you've got nothing to sell, we hope to have a good crop next year. Yeah, because I think if you compare 10, 11, 12 and 13, in four vintages in one row, we can say we have lost a crop. Yeah, definitely.
Do you think you'll be able to, in the future vintages, also purchase the Grand Cru fruit? Are you going to be able to source the Batard and Chevalier going forward?
I believe, yes. It's on the way. It's on the way. And I'm happy, because in 2013, I make one more barrel of Batard. I was able to buy, and the good thing is we pick ourselves this block. So I was able to get one more barrel, so it's going to be two barrels, which is good. So it's good news. Yes, we hope. It's always difficult to see the future with these very sought-after vineyards. But the people I work with, I trust, and I think it's going to be okay.
And what about the market for your wines? Mm-hmm. Have you seen, as the styles of what you're doing in both the vineyard and the winery have changed over the course of about 15 years, have you seen changes in where the wines sell or a customer response?
I've seen some, we export 70% of our production, and what stays in France, it's mostly goes in a restaurant and in retailer. Yes, I've seen some. Of course, the distribution still is the same, except from we have got some new country, new market. But the feedback I receive for people who follow us since more than 10 years, I'm happy to hear people say, oh, this is different now. Your style of Chardonnay changed. It's more finer. Need more time, but I like to say that people say your wine are a bit more digest, you know, in a good way. I like when people say, oh, my glass is empty, and you know, another one.
So you're 38. Have you seen generational change in Burgundy? Does it seem to be a different place or a little bit different place or the same place as when your dad was 38?
You mean the evolution of the new generation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think there is more and more unknown domains going to be on the market. Because of the new generation, this is like that. Some people where they've got a good vineyards, well made, but you know, to sell wine under your name, you need you have to make the wine, you have to make it good, and then you have to sell it. It takes time to sell it. If you want to export, so you have to move a little bit. You have to. Well, I'm here today. You have to move to sell your wine, and I think what I did to go overseas in the 90s. Today, a lot of people do that and be more open mind. And I've got many friends, a lot of friends, where their dad they just sell in bulk or in juice or in grapes, and they slowly keep more and more and more each year to grow their brand, and which is good news for Burgundy, because some domain today, because of the big demand, are going to be very hard to get, because there is every year there is a new market. So I think in the short future, people will be able to get some good wines made from some people for the moment they don't know, but it's important time now for buyers, for sommeliers, for distributor, importer, to get in Burgundy to say who is going to be soon a very good producer, because there is some big names already in Burgundy, but there is some potentially a good noyau, comment on dit ça, a good proportion of future good domain.
So you're born in the 1970s, mid-1970s.
Yeah.
As you've grown up and assumed control of your own estate, domain,
mm-hmm.
have you seen visitors to Burgundy change? Is it different people than used to come to visit the region from different countries?
Yeah. Of course, now you can see more Asian people comes to discover, to learn, because to drink Burgundy, you have to know a little bit, because sometimes I understand people, they don't understand, they don't, it's not because they don't like Burgundy, it's just because they don't understand. The most easier thing is Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, boom, that's a good thing. But after, I can feel that some people, they just don't understand why there is 50 different producers of Chassin Marché, Premier Cru, Morgeau. So when they come, they look, and somebody takes the time to explain after they understand. And yes, there is more and more people. But you know, Burgundy has always been very touristic. And geographically, it's on the way to north to the south when you cross France. So there is a lot of Dutch people, German, Belgium, comes to Burgundy to make a stop before to go to holidays to the south of France. And this has been always. But that's for sure, you can see more and more people. But Burgundy attracts people more and more. That's true. Yeah.
And what do you see that might be the future progression for your own domain in the next 14 years? What do you anticipate happening going forward?
I hope to get more vineyard, you know, but we will see. Actually, I'm going to have next year one new appellation. Some Chassin-Morachet Premier Cru Clos Saint-Jean, white, first crop. It's a new vineyard. So, you know, things like that to extend a little bit. The future for us, yes, we always see what's up about the extending, but the price of the land now is very, very complicated for us to pay. So we've got what we've got. It's great. I'm happy with that. And the future is try each year to do the best as we can to keep the pressure, to keep the quality, and to be able to sell the wine easily. Yeah. For the moment, it works, but it's a point where sometimes you say, okay, it works, it's too easy. No, just keep the pressure. Just keep the pressure with the quality. And, you know, I'm now in Manhattan for selling my wine through my distributor. And because they do a great job, I'm happy today. We have seen many, many customers. And happy to say, we know your wine. We follow you since many years, and just now want me to show the new vintage. I don't have some clients. I don't have to start from the beginning to say who I am, what we want to make, what we try to do. On the point where people look forward to wait for the new vintage, and so try to keep the quality, the pressure. To any vintage is a challenge every year, and try to do the best.
Alex Moreau at Domaine Bernard Moreau, he's tackling new challenges, and if you are not familiar with the wines, perhaps you should be. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Capiello of Pearl and Ash has a few things to say about the 750 service.
Yes, I do. 750 has changed my life. I'm notoriously not the smartest wine buyer in the industry. So to have somebody pretty much lay it out for me step by step, it's definitely become a lot easier to buy wine, which isn't necessarily a good thing for my business partners, but it's worked really well for my clients. But yeah, no, 750 for sure. I remember times when wines would leave portfolios and, you know, they don't always send you a goodbye email when they do that. And tracking those wines down, after it's been a year or more, it's not always been the easiest thing. And even with the internet as a whole, I think not always good resources, but 750 has done a great job, I think, of giving you the ability to find a wine no matter where it is.
Patrick Capiello of Pearl and Ash, he's a 750 user. You should be too.
And that's this week's episode of I'll Drink to That. We release a new show each Tuesday and every other Friday. You can find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on our own dedicated website, I'll Drink to That Pod. .com, no apostrophe. Thanks for listening.